Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. At the age of 65, Caitlyn Jenner has just become the world's most famous trans woman. For decades before she went public with what she says is her true identity, Jenner lived as Bruce Jenner, who earned fame and fortune as a gold medal decathlete but struggled mightily to be comfortable in the male body she was born with. Jenner says her experience of what's called gender dysphoria started early in her life, and it turns out many trans people realize as early as childhood that they feel they were somehow born the wrong sex for the gender they identify with. Children's Medical Center of Dallas recently opened a program to help young patients affected by gender dysphoria find their identities through intensive psychiatric and sometimes medical interventions. We have two physicians who work with these children joining us to talk about the challenges they and their families can face in making decisions about an aspect of identity most of us are able to take for granted as correct from birth. Dr. Jimena Lopez is medical director for the Gender Education and Care Interdisciplinary Support Program at Children's, known as Genesis. Dr. Meredith Chapman is a psychiatrist at Children's Medical Center and UT Southwestern Medical Center. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you.
How do children come to realize that their identity is different from their birth sex? What do they tell you is their first inkling that something is not as everyone assumes it to be?
So, you know, we are seeing children at a little bit older age, but I think across the board when we ask them and when we ask their parents to tell us their stories, their experience, that we hear things that even at a very young age, which is somewhat shocking, I think, to parents and perhaps, you know, people in the general public, that as early as 2, maybe 3 years old, that there are definite indications that the child is experiencing some distress related to the difference between who they are and who sort of the world sees them as or their assigned sex at birth.
How frequently does this happen?
The prevalence in childhood is difficult to ascertain because it's probably underestimated. And there's no good studies that can evaluate for that. But what we have so far in terms of data ranges from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 3,000.
There's been some terrific local reporting on this lately in the Dallas Morning News. There are TV and movie characters that maybe for the first time in history don't simply take trans people and make them an object of ridicule, but try to explore them as full human beings. I wonder, though, are you finding, even with this program, that a lot of people just assumed this was an adult issue and not something that children would deal with?
I would say my personal experience, has been being a child and adolescent psychiatrist, that many adults assume that children and adolescents don't have to deal with many of the things that adults have to deal with. So to compare it to something like depression or anxiety, which, you know, we know children experience, but for, periods in history that maybe we thought children and adolescents didn't experience, I think it's very similar that, some adults may have a difficult time accepting that, you know, a child or even an adolescent is sort of sophisticated enough from a cognitive or a emotional development standpoint to, you know, be able to express these things and talk about them and even feel them, which I think we have known increasingly over the last couple of years is very true, that this is happening. And just because we're not talking about it doesn't mean that it isn't occurring.
Do we know why it happens? I'm thinking about the difference, if there is one, between the formation of cisgender identity, which if I had this correct, is identifying with the gender of the sex that you were born mm-hmm. in or with. Is that different somehow than the formation of a gender dysphoric identity?
So I wouldn't say that a person has a gender dysphoric identity.
Thank you for the correction.
Yes. Gender dysphoria is, it's a diagnosis in the DSM, which is our Diagnostical and Statistical Manual in Psychiatry. And it's a diagnosis because it is the distress and the discomfort that a person experiences because their sex assigned at birth doesn't match their gender. And gender really, in my mind, encompasses your sex, your biological sex, plus how you identify yourself, plus how you express that. So it's gender identification and gender expression. So the gender dysphoria, while it is a diagnosis, really talks about that distress. So being transgender itself is not a diagnosis. Transgender is an umbrella term that encompasses lots of things.
How did the need for a clinic like this become apparent at Children's?
Well, I would have to go back to the Netherlands because in the 1990s, they had developed a gender clinic that would provide psychiatric therapy for young children and adolescents, as Dr. Chapman has said, because of their high risk of suicide and depression. And they had one patient that was on psychiatric medication for depression since age 7. And by age 12, she really wanted to kill herself if she didn't become a boy. And one of the psychiatrists had the idea of talking with a pediatric endocrinologist and asking, is there anything we can do to relieve this distress? Because this patient is suffering, she wants to die, and there's nothing else I can do. And they had the idea of trying a medication to suppress puberty, which is something that we as endocrinologists have used for more than 30 years for children who start puberty earlier than normal. We call it precocious puberty, and that we know it's a safe and reversible treatment. So they balance the benefit of using something, you know, it's safe and reversible, and the risk of not doing anything new because she was already suicidal. The outcome was very good. This patient was taken off antidepressants, ended up transitioning fully to a male, had hormonal treatment, surgery, became a physician, and never regretted the decision and was functioning really well. So they had the idea of developing a research protocol that in which they would have a larger group of patients in which they would start treatment to block puberty around the age of 12. And that made very strict criteria from the mental health standpoint in terms of a long history and very consistent of this gender dysphoria or cross-gender identity. And they followed them very closely by their mental health team, psychiatrists and psychologists. By age 16, which is the legal age in the Netherlands to consent to medical care, they could get, if they wanted, hormonal treatment to develop in the gender they identify with. So that is estrogen or testosterone. And then when they turned 18, they could have surgery if that's what they wanted. So they followed 70 patients under this research protocol, and all of them went through the process. None of them regretted their decision. And their psychological outcome was similar or better than the average Dutch young adult.
Wow.
And their quality of life was similar or better. So at that point, when historically the transgender population is a population that when they manifest in adolescence, they often run away from home. They have high-risk behaviors, drug addiction, suicide, prostitution, and end up being people that are not functioning in society, no job, no school. The comparison is abysmal. So this data supported the Endocrine Society and the Pediatric Endocrine Society to adopt the Dutch protocol as a standard of care for children and adolescents who meet very specific criteria. This has to be done under a multidisciplinary team that not only involves the endocrinologist who's providing the medical treatment, but a mental health team that's assessing the patient to see that they meet the criteria and monitoring the patient. And these guidelines have been out there since 2009, okay? So it's been a few years. Patients and families were aware of this. And they came to our clinic 3 years ago asking for this treatment, okay? So we decided to find the resources and build a team that we could so we could evaluate and treat these patients, because there's really no good alternative for these families. But this, and so far, research shows that this is the best outcome there is for these patients. So that's how we came to the decision of having this clinic.
What are you looking for when patients come to you for the first time? What would an initial screening look like in terms of the psychiatric screening and also the physiological tests and evaluations that would take place?
So we follow a protocol that's very similar to the Dutch protocol. When a patient is referred first, and this usually comes from a community therapist or a pediatrician or sometimes even the parent, we do an intake over the phone for about an hour, and we get a history, and we assess, does this sound like a patient we should see? And after that, we recommend 6 months of therapy with a psychologist or a therapist if they haven't had that already. And that therapist needs to let us know if they believe this patient has gender dysphoria or if they believe there are reasons why these patients should be seen in our clinic. So that's a first step, okay? After those 6 months and we have this letter, we have a very thorough evaluation by our team, which includes psychology and psychiatry and social work. The team evaluates the parents and the child separately, and Dr. Chapman can talk more about the details of that evaluation. After that, we meet as a team with endocrinology, adolescent medicine, psychiatry, psychology, and social work. We discuss the case. We discuss what our recommendations are at that point and in the near future. Recommendations can be maybe more therapy for now, the case is not clear, or it could be a puberty suppression. And at that point, then the patient can be referred to the endocrinologist or the adolescent clinic, which is where we also provide medical therapy. And after that, we follow the patient every 3 months. The patient has to be on ongoing therapy, and we repeat the thorough psychological evaluation yearly to make sure the patient has better psychological outcomes and it's moving on track as we expect.
Can you talk a little bit, Meredith, about the psychiatric evaluation and the therapy? Often when people think about therapy, they think there is a problem, we're going to fix this problem, and the solution may be different from what people imagine.
Right. So just to, I think, build upon what Dr. Lopez has shared is that, you know, when a family makes that first call to our clinic, we are really trying to assess multiple facets of that child's life. One is certainly whether there is gender dysphoria present or not. We also want to establish sort of their psychosocial history. We want to know what their context is, what's going on in their life, their social emotional health, but how they're functioning at school or in their family. Because certainly, you know, this patient population, this group of children and adolescents we're seeing are at risk. Dr. Lopez has hinted to increased risk of, and certainly we're seeing this as well, depression, anxiety, suicidal thinking, suicide attempts.
Let me have you pause right there. We're going to finish this right after the break. My guests this hour are Dr. Meredith Chapman, who is a psychiatrist at Children's Medical Center and UT Southwestern Medical Center. Also, Dr. Jimena Lopez, who is a medical director for the Gender Education and Care Interdisciplinary Support Program called Genesis at Children's Medical Center. We're talking about caring for transgender children. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about care for transgender children with Dr. Jimena Lopez of UT Southwestern. She's also medical director of the Gender Education and Care Interdisciplinary Support Program called Genesis at Children's Medical Center. Dr. Meredith Chapman, a psychiatrist, works there as well, and she's also with UT Southwestern Medical Center. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You were speaking before, Dr. Chapman, about the risk of suicide if these children are not provided with some kind of intervention.
Mm-hmm. Jimena was talking about sort of a historical approach to how our clinic started. And I just want to share briefly that how I got involved with the clinic was Jimena called and said, I need a psychiatrist who is an expert in treating transgender youth. And she says, are you that person? And I said, no. And she says, do you know that person? And I said, no. And then I said, but I'm willing to learn mm-hmm. because my experience with transgender youth at this time, which is about, well, it'll be 3 years in July, was taking care of them after a suicide attempt. Mm-hmm. So working as a child and adolescent psychiatrist in an inpatient psychiatric setting and caring for youth that were transgender and who had gotten to a point that they felt like their only option was to end their life. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of my experience getting involved with this particular group. So we do see very high rates of depression, anxiety, suicidal thinking, suicidal behaviors, including suicide attempts and self-injury as a result of some of the struggles these youth face. They're also significantly at risk of violence, harassment in school, in their community, and even in their homes. I think Jimena mentioned sort of high rates of running away, substance use, all those things. So this is an at-risk youth, at-risk group of youth.
So when you are providing therapy, you are working on issues of depression and issues of frustration and a sense of not belonging and not being accepted. Mm-hmm. How do you try to determine whether what's really at the heart of these problems is this sense that gender identity and birth sex don't match?
Mm-hmm. So in our program in Genesis, the mental health component that we primarily provide is what we call a mental health readiness assessment. So our job as the mental health team is to really assess whether the gender dysphoria that is presenting, that has brought the youth and their family to us, is to a degree that warrants medical intervention. So there are many treatments for gender dysphoria. One of them happens to be medical intervention. So our job is to really thoroughly investigate the insistency of the gender dysphoria, how strongly the child or adolescent feels that, the consistency, how sort of stable it's been over time, and then the persistency. So how long has it lasted? Has it been there for a month? Has it been there for a year? Has it been there since age two? And based on those three factors, the insistency, consistency, and persistency, we try to make a recommendation about whether medical intervention seems like a reasonable next step.
Is it ever an appropriate treatment to help a child dealing with gender dysphoria to find their way back to an identity that matches birth sex?
Absolutely. I want to couch that and say not absolutely. So we know that what are called reparative therapies have proven not to be effective and are considered unethical by many, many professional associations, including, the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatric Association. What we do recommend, particularly in younger kids, is that essentially the door is always open, that there is a significant degree of inconsistency in younger children, particularly before puberty has started, and that it is the role of parents, teachers, community members, family members, and health professionals to sort of support that child in their gender expression, whatever it may be, and to not close the door really on anything, because it is a period of great fluidity and variability. So in that respect, yes, I do think that, you know, there is an appropriate time to allow for that expression, whatever it may be, and for that to change. I think what we see in adolescence is that it becomes much more unlikely that a child or an adolescent will change their mind, so to speak, and, you know, feel like their gender and their natal sex are more aligned. It actually usually is the opposite, that those feelings just become stronger and intensify, and there's more distress associated with the development of, you know, specific sex characteristics that are, you know, specific to either gender.
So holding off puberty, this is something that, as you mentioned, Dr. Lopez, can be reversed or can be sort of at the point at which that's believed to be no longer appropriate. I guess nature takes its course or some hormones can be used. What is the benefit of sort of buying time before the permanent changes that come about with puberty take place?
Well, the purpose of the puberty blockers are, one is to buy time, and that is for very young children, as they work with their therapies, they can continue to explore their gender identity in a safe way, because puberty blockers are pretty safe and it's reversible. And we emphasize, as Dr. Chapman said, the door is open. And we emphasize this to the parents and children. The fact that they're on a puberty blocker, that doesn't mean they have to take the track to be transgender.
Mm-hmm.
It's to help them continue to explore their gender identity with the therapist without the stress of puberty. Because many of these children are stressed, very stressed for the fact that their, you know, body's changing, males and females at different parts. They imagine their body in a different way completely. And they always hope, maybe as children, that it would magically turn into a male or a female, and it's going the opposite way.
Mm-hmm.
So they're realizing that, and that's very stressful. They want to cut their body parts, and just the relief of not happening, which is it's really put into a pause. It's not that it's not making it go away. It just puts it into a pause. So whatever's there, it's there. It just puts it into a pause, and nothing continues to progress in terms of puberty, and so it provides that relief. Okay. And then we want to do that before any irreversible change is done from hormone therapy. So hormone therapy meaning giving testosterone or estrogen, that has irreversible effects. So we don't want to do that in somebody who hasn't had the time to explore their gender identity, who hasn't been on a puberty suppression first.
Do girls on puberty blockers end up taller? Do boys on puberty blockers end up shorter than those who don't delay whatever the onset would be naturally?
That's a really good question. Puberty blockers, when they are giving to an adolescent who's already having a growth spurt, so from sex hormones normally produced during puberty, they're growing at a faster rate than before. When you put them on a puberty blocker, they go back to the rate that they were at before puberty. So this is a field that's still under investigation, but the small data we have suggests that once these children either their own natural sex hormones take on because you stop the puberty blocker, which, you know, that happens very infrequently, but if that were to happen, then they do catch up to their final height and normal height. Or if they continue through the Dutch protocol and they get cross-sex hormones, they actually achieve a pretty normal height that is not very different to what they would have had without the puberty blocker.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I wanted to say is that puberty itself, the changes that puberty causes, but you're on estrogen or testosterone, causes irreversible changes in your body. And the only way to undo them in the long term is through surgery. And sometimes that's just not good enough for many transgender people. The cosmetic results are not great. And it's very expensive and sometimes not paid by insurance. So that's one of the other benefits of the puberty blocker. You're giving time for those things not to happen, because when they happen, they're irreversible. So the physical transition ends up being very smooth. Because if you limit that own puberty and then you transition hormonally to the gender you identify with, physically it's a smoother transition there's less surgery needed, and socially that also improves their well-being because they're able to pass as the gender they identify with, which is very important for them.
Before we start taking calls, I just want to get to this. Even in cases, and I would imagine that these are the ones that are easiest for you both to work with, where parents are on board with this and really just want to do what's best for the child, this is a big thing to get accustomed to. You know, people find out what they believe to be the sex of their baby before babies are born these days, and they've had a relationship with a child of one gender or the other and are not expecting that to change. What kind of care do families need to sort of process this in a healthy way and even process what might be, I guess, reasonably called a form of grief for what is changing?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We, you know, in working with families, this is a process. It's, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head, right, that the first three words that are said about any person, right, it's a boy, it's a girl. And so all of the sudden when you're faced with the prospect that maybe that was an inaccurate or false statement, but you have sort of, you know, lived up until a certain point in that experience, it is a process. And I think from the mental health perspective side, the child or adolescent actually gets there very quickly. And it's often there's a delay between when they know and when they actually tell someone. And so it's a bit of a catch-up process for parents, you know, and sometimes they tell one parent and then tell the next parent. And it's this continual process of telling people. So if you've come out to your family, then it's coming out at school or making that choice to come out in the community. So supporting parents and siblings, you know, and family members that are supportive to the child or adolescent is incredibly important. And we are lucky, you know, we have a pretty biased population because we are taking care of, you know, children and adolescents whose parents have come to the point or the realization that this is the treatment that their child needs. But still, that can be fraught with challenges. So we support not only the family, but support them, not only support them through sort of their emotional challenges, but even challenges about how do we interface with the school system and how do we go about, you know, making sure that my child is being called the right name and the right pronouns are being used, or how do we go about legally changing a name? So that is a huge part of our work, is providing not only the emotional support for these families, but some of those very practical issues as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Emily in Dallas. Hi, Emily.
Hello. I have a question about what if a, or should a parent or a provider bring the topic up of transgender to a child, or should they allow the child to bring that up to them?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a great question, Emily. So I have a bit of a bias being a psychiatrist, because there's an old adage that you shouldn't talk about suicide because it might make someone want to kill themselves, which we know is not true. So I equate it very similarly. You know, it's we don't want a policy of don't ask, don't tell. And I certainly am in a position of, you know, not only interacting with a lot of transgender kids, but interacting with a lot of, you know, cisgender, which would be, you know, your sex and your gender align. And I think it's very important that we ask about gender and sexuality in a way that's inappropriate. So for a young child, you know, I might say something like, you know, you know, there's girls and boys, and most girls, you know, feel like they're a girl on the inside, and they express that in a certain way. They show that they're a girl by doing certain things and wearing certain clothes, and, you know, and boys are the same way. But sometimes there are maybe girls who, on the outside, look like girls, but on the inside, they really feel like boys. Have you ever felt that way? You know, you sort of, I think, can broach the topic, or with adolescents, you know, sort of, you can say there are, you know, various ways that people feel and express their gender. And where do you fall on sort of a continuum from, you know, zero being completely female and 10 being completely male? You know, where do you fall on that? So there's some really thoughtful ways to ask these questions that doesn't plant a seed which is what I think sometimes people worry, that if you ask these questions, you're going to, you know, automatically get a child or adolescent thinking in a manner, which is just not true.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi. And I hope you'll excuse me if I'm misquoting this study, but I've heard of a study that says that the incidence of depression and psychiatric illnesses in transgender individuals does not get any better after they, I guess, reassign their gender. My question is if that's true, why is gender dysphoria not being treated like a psychiatric illness instead of a condition where people can change gender based on how they identify?
Yeah, I think we've got your question, Jim. Thanks, and we'll see about getting an answer for you.
Yeah, I guess Dr. Chapman probably has something to say, but I do want to say that transgender, there is data that shows that hormonal therapy is beneficial to transgenders from the psychological point of view, and surgery is too, but the results are not dramatic. There's still people who remain depressed and commit suicide even after hormonal therapy and surgery. The hypothesis is that these patients have already had a lifelong situation of depression, and it's kind of too late in a way. Their lives are already very complicated. They've have poor relationships. They don't have a job. So it's kind of on the late side. And precisely what the Dutch protocol shows is that when you intervene early and with support from families, mental health, and have a smooth transition, that the outcome is completely different.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Ximena Lopez and Dr. Meredith Chapman. Both work with the Gender Education and Care Interdisciplinary Support Program, or GENESIS, at Children's Medical Center and with UT Southwestern Medical Center. We're talking this hour about caring for transgender children. You can be part of our conversation at 800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Meredith Chapman, a psychiatrist at Children's Medical Center and UT Southwestern Medical Center, and Dr. Ximena Lopez, medical director for the Gender Education and Care Interdisciplinary Support Program, or GENESIS, at Children's Medical Center, and also she works with UT Southwestern. We're talking about caring for transgender children. You can join our conversation at think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. We have an email here from Karen who asks, are these children mostly female wanting to be male or the opposite?
So I've recently been looking just at the, we've seen 102 youth, and our ratios are exactly 1-to-1. So there's no difference between the number of affirmed males we're seeing or affirmed females we're seeing. So 1-to-1, which is pretty consistent with what other, I think, clinics and programs have reported. So the Dutch program and there's a program in Boston also reports similar data.
If a family and care providers and a child decide that what's appropriate is to sort of externally take on the identity of the gender that they identify with that is different from their birth sex, is it preferable to change schools and maybe give that child a shot at just being who or she feels he or she is without, you know, kids who have a history of them being presented as something different?
I think that's a complicated question and a complicated answer, mm-hmm. and it has many variables and moving parts that need to be considered. And a lot of that has to do with how accepting and supportive and affirmative the school itself is. So for, you know, some of the children I've worked with, they've been able to successfully transition at school and feel very supported from not only their peers, but from teachers and administrative staff. And there, you know, certainly have been instances where that has not been the case and that parents have had to actually, you know, fight through the legal system to get, you know, protections for their child. So I think that yes and no, there certainly could be benefits, but there also could be some drawbacks, and it would really have to be decided on a case-by-case basis.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Debbie in Fort Worth. Hi, Debbie.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Hi. I'm a student at Bright Divinity School, and I'm just wondering if you have chaplains on your team, because spirituality and sexuality are really connected.
Well, thanks for your call.
Thank you for your question. Actually, yes, we do. We have pastoral care as part of the program, just recently joined. We do have a lot of patients in which their spirituality or religious beliefs is a big issue in their accepting the gender identity of their child. I would say that most of those who have a strong faith actually continuing their faith. They don't stop being, you know, religious in any way. They do have to maybe change churches or congregations or communities to ones that are more accepting. But we do realize that's a very important part of their lives, and we are starting to provide that.
Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence that is the point at which, after delaying puberty, assuming that you get a child at a relatively young age into the clinic, is there any evidence that providing cross-sex hormones has a reinforcing effect on a sense of gender identity? Does the question make sense to you?
That's a really good question. I guess you could ask in a way if hormones have effects on brains and how they so brains masculinize or feminize, and the hormones that have that effect. We see that in adults from transgender adults, which have had specific types of brain MRIs. And when they get testosterone, for example, biological females get testosterone, their brains masculinize. And there you can see changes in the brain. We don't know the answer to that. That's a really good question.
To be clear, women produce testosterone and men produce estrogen, but in much different amounts naturally.
Both of them, exactly. Both of them produce both hormones, but the ratios are completely different. Mm-hmm. So we do know that the brain is masculinized or feminized in during gestation. And there are certain medical conditions where if, let's say, chromosomal female gets exposed to high androgen or testosterone levels, that brain can masculinize, and that girl can have masculine-type behaviors later on. So we don't know whether when it's given later in life, you know, in adolescence or adulthood, can that have an effect. What we do know is that hormones provide significant relief from their, you know, distress, depression, and anxiety very soon after it started. They do. I mean, patients really tell you, this is, I feel now myself, this is what I needed, I feel different. Pretty early on, it's pretty actually fascinating.
I know that a transgender identity does not necessarily track in any predictable way with sexual orientation. But I wonder what kind of assistance these young people need as they are considering these transitions, considering who they are and who they want to be, and also arriving at the age where people start dating and start having romantic relationships.
Mm-hmm. again, very complicated. I have to say that I learn more from the patients I see on a day-in and day-out basis. You would be surprised how sophisticated and knowledgeable kids are about these issues, and it's ever-changing, the terminology, all of these things. But it really is important, and sometimes I think that they can really school adults on the differences between sexuality and gender, because they're two, you know, completely and very different things. You know, in terms of how these adolescents and these, you know, children are dating or identifying, even who they're attracted to, it's really variable. And we have worked with youth who, you know, identify as heterosexual, as homosexual, as bisexual, as asexual, you name it. And so I think, again, that is something that in the process of therapy needs to be explored and supported. And that it is, though, you know, something that we talk with particular adolescents about in terms of safety, because there are some concerns that, you know, particularly if you are perhaps, you know, presenting yourself to the outside world in a way that they expect a certain match between how you look and dress and what, you know, your private parts are. And then there's a surprise sort of at the end of the day that can really, you know, put adolescents in particular in danger for their physical safety. So we do have to have, and parents have to have those very, I think, even more difficult conversations than what they would usually be about sexuality and sexual behavior with this particular population, because some of those very specific inherent dangers.
I know the Dutch research is still relatively recent, so a lot of these patients are still very much in young adulthood. But I wonder if there's been any work done to see whether people who begin a gender transition as children or adolescents are any more or less likely than anyone else in the general population to report satisfying coupled relationships as adults?
That's a really good question. I don't think that there's data on that. What I do know from experience is that a lot of our patients, they're very afraid about sexual romantic relationships, and I feel it's delayed age-wise compared to their cisgender peers because they're very afraid of, you know, people finding out or, you know, that situation that might be unsafe. So it's a really complicated situation.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Dick on the line in Arlington. Hi, Dick.
Hey, Chris. I'm really enjoying the program because you never get to hear this kind of stuff. I have a question. Is this considered a mental illness or not, or is it something in between? And also, is this also any kind of other situation like this that requires as much therapy?
Thanks for your call.
So in terms of whether or not, you know, gender dysphoria is a diagnosis that is included in the DSM, which is the Diagnostic Manual for Psychiatrists in this country and other places as well. The ICD, which is the International Classification of Disease, which is another system of sort of naming things, also considers gender identity disorder as a diagnosis. I think what needs to be made clear is that just like any other diagnosis a person might have, it does not define you. So I might be a person who has high blood pressure, or there might be a child who has diabetes, but that is not that person. So gender dysphoria defines that a person has this discomfort or the distress that's associated with this mismatch between their, you know, sex that was assigned at birth and their gender, but that this the dysphoria that is, it's that distress that is the diagnosis. It's not the actual state of having that difference or that mismatch. I don't know if I'm speaking clearly or not.
I think you are. Is it possible, though, to have the mismatch without having distress?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And precisely one of the outcomes of the Dutch study is that this dysphoria pretty much goes away, and this distress, because they are functioning like males or females in their, you know, identified gender. They don't feel transgender or, you know, different in a way, just males and females.
What kinds of weapons, if that's the right word, do you arm young people with to talk to their peers about any transition that they might be going through?
Again,
complicated.
You know, complicated. Yes, I feel like I'm a broken record. You know, I think it's helping children and adolescents, you know, develop language around, you know, all of these concepts, one, but two, you know, that it's also educating them some about confidentiality, mm-hmm. about, you know, and that would certainly not be a term that I would use with a child, but, you know, there are things like rumors and, you know, your best friend may agree to secrecy, but that doesn't, you know, extend beyond the moment of that conversation. And so, you know, not only is it sort of preparing them to be able to talk about some of the intricacies of their lives, and we have, you know, several patients who have participated with us in interviews and in programs and presentations that are much more eloquent about talking about, I think, their experiences than either Jimena and I, either one, are. But it's being able to sort of pick and choose and to do that in a safe environment.
I hate to bring it around to this, but how much of this is covered by regular insurance?
It's a really good question. So this treatment, in particular, the medications used to suppress puberty are very expensive. They cost about $15,000 a year.
Wow.
Yes. So if it's not covered by insurance, there's very few people that can afford that, of course. It's been an interesting process because we've noticed over the last 2 years or so, insurances are starting to cover it more and more, both Medicaid and commercial insurances. The issue in the past has been that this is a treatment that is called off-label, because the FDA has not approved these medications for this diagnosis. For example, you know, the label has precocious puberty or early puberty, but not gender dysphoria. And that's because the companies that make these medications have not submitted their request to the FDA, and they have to do their own studies, and we're in a very early phase for that. I think it will come, but we're not there yet. But we have been able to have our patients get their insurance, most of them, get cover for the medications by going through a prior authorization process or sending letters explaining that this is the standard of care and that we leave this, and this, there's a necessity for this medication, and most of them have been covering it.
Dr. Jimena Lopez is Medical Director for the Gender Education and Care Interdisciplinary Support Program at Children's Medical Center, also known as Genesis, and she works at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Dr. Meredith Chapman is a psychiatrist at Children's Medical Center and at UT Southwestern Medical Center. It's been great to have you both here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.